Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the Local Edition. And I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Well, coming up, we're going to learn all about Ability. It's a new app developed in the Hudson Valley that's for people with developmental disabilities and their supporters. Plus, it's back to school season, and it looks like e-cigarettes are getting ready as well. Health officials are warning of a new wave of e-cigarettes that are targeting kids. Some even have built-in video games. We have both those stories coming up in the second half of the program. We start tonight with a big news update on the town of Highland, which has released its final audit of its clerk's office. And the report highlights millions of dollars of deposits that have no documentation. Meanwhile, the clerk's legal team is calling the whole process a politically motivated witch hunt. For all the details, Tim Bruno spoke to Liam Mayo, news editor for the River Reporter, live this morning on Radio Chatskill.
Back in February, the Highland Town Board voted to pass a couple of resolutions censuring the town clerk, Sue Hoffman, and seizing her town computer, turning it over to the New York State Police. According to the resolution where they explained that action, they stated that Susan Hoffman, town clerk, has engaged in gross negligence regarding her duties, resulting in a failure to produce and maintain critical town records dating back to 2021, thereby hindering the effective operation of town government and eroding public confidence in the integrity of the town's administration. So that was the sort of kickoff to this. And then in May, the town released kind of a preliminary version of this report. And then that has led to this final version of the report that was released this past Tuesday at a Town of Highland board meeting.
Now, the findings of the final report, do they follow those from the preliminary report, or did anything sort of change significantly?
They pretty much follow the findings from the preliminary report. There's a little bit more information added, like the preliminary report looking at 2022 and 2023 found that deposits to a specific town account exceeded recorded receipts by around $4.5 million in total. The final audit adds 2024 to that period surveyed and increases that total variance to just under $5.4 million. So it continues on in kind of the same vein, but the team conducting the report found a couple of other things as they continued on in their efforts.
Tell us more about that $5.4 million in undocumented deposits. What's missing?
Yeah. So what isn't missing is money. As of right now, there is no allegation that there are missing funds from the town's accounts. But what is missing is records and receipts documenting like where those deposits came from, which over that 3-year period adds up to around $5.3 million more in deposits to that bank account than system recorded receipts. And the reason why this is concerning, other than just, you know, the fact that good record keeping is always generally important, according to the report, there's a current inability to determine where the extra deposits come from or which taxpayers they are attributable to. And when the variance between system records and deposits is this large, it is also impossible to determine if there are missing deposits. So what they're saying is that they aren't sure where this money came from, but because there is such a large gap between the amount of money in the accounts and the number of receipts or the amount recorded in the town's receipts, it's impossible for them to say if there were missing deposits. Like, the evidence wouldn't necessarily be there to point out that money was missing.
And it sounds like there were some, just in the process of the town in some ways of not having a very significant audit, it seems, because it was a long period where there was this variance, and then it was certainly then just discovered, but then the town has now voted to, I guess, amend that process.
Yeah, the town is going to meet in, or the town board is going to meet in September to decide kind of what exactly they're going to do in response to this. But some of the stuff recommended, or one of the things recommended to be done in the report was to rebuild, or to basically like go back through the reports and records that have been done and take on a reconciliation process and confirm that all transactions have been appropriately recorded. So go back through those past couple of years of missing records and build that up. And one of the other things that may come out of it is changes to the way the town clerk's office operates. Some of the other things that the report found were that there were not significant procedures and policies in place in the town clerk's office to govern some of this stuff. And it found that there was significant issues with timeliness as regards several parts of the town clerk's operation. So those kinds of things may be what the town ends up addressing with new policies or new procedures.
And in your report at riverreporter.com, some of those timeliness issues include making bank deposits, remitting monthly revenue to the town, and other legal filings. Also, the town board is voted to require a secondary signer for all town bank accounts, and we'll be holding a meeting on September 2nd to discuss responses to the report. Now, what's the response been from Sue Hoffman, the town clerk?
We haven't heard specifically from the town clerk, although she has been present at these meetings where these reports are being discussed. However, during the public comment portion of the meeting that followed the release of this report, Attorney Michael McGuire spoke on her behalf. He said that, quote, this board has taken on the personality of a vigilante rogue mob by creating the illusion of public corruption in the office of the town clerk. And he said that the report, quote, weaponized town government against a public servant.
And the Attorney McGuire said that there was no evidence of wrongdoing, and that the, quote, smoking gun in the report was that some, quote, philanthropist had deposited excess money into the town's accounts. What's that about?
Oh, that I believe he's referring to the $5.4 million, basically saying, like, oh, wow, we have more money than is recorded. That's such a big problem, like being sarcastic about it. But you know, as we've previously discussed, there are some significant concerns when there is a significant portion of money in town accounts that does not have appropriate record keeping behind it.
What's the town supervisor in the town of Highland saying?
Yeah, earlier on in the investigation, he said that the goal was not to eliminate the town clerk, Sue Hoffman, but, quote, to make sure town funds and information aren't compromised. He has also previously said that these findings kind of in the preliminary report are concerning and that they will hopefully inform a more secure town of Highland moving forward. He's also said that this situation more recently is going to be a statewide investigation very soon. And early on in the process, the New York State Police were involved in seizing the town clerk's computer. So there is that sort of statewide link already present.
It seems as if the town of Highland has had some dramatic developments in the last few years. Is this just part of that, or is there something more to it? What's your take there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there is an incredibly politically charged atmosphere in the town of Highland. A couple of years ago, the town ended up eliminating its constable's department under fairly similar circumstances where there was a report, there were allegations made of mismanagement or of improper procedures. There was a lot of kind of political back and forth about it. People got really up in arms. And I think both, or there two things can kind of both be true, which is the findings of this report could be true in that there are need to be better procedures in place for the town clerk's office, but also that findings are happening in a very politically charged environment where the different sides of town politics are going to have their different opinions on what those findings mean or how that should be brought about.
And so I mentioned that there's a meeting that's coming up on September 2nd where they'll discuss the responses to the report. And then is there another meeting coming up after that where they will make any kind of changes?
Yeah, I believe the September 2nd meeting is the town board workshop meeting, so they would be able to discuss the report. And then the following week's meeting on the 9th would be sort of the full official meeting of the town board where they would be able to make the kinds of changes we've been talking about in addressing this report.
Have you heard anything from the community about the reaction to this yet or other anyone else?
We haven't heard yet that there's been a specific reaction, but one of the things that may end up having more of a reaction as we get into a couple of months from now. We saw that according to filings from the Sullivan County Board of Elections, the current deputy supervisor has filed to be on the ballot for the 2025 election for the Highland Town Clerk position. So this may end up being a campaign issue as well as a like town governance issue.
Okay. And it's an interesting development there with the deputy supervisor. Is there a conflict of interest there in terms of anything going on?
Yeah, that was what McGuire said. He claimed that, or he said that Kidney, the deputy supervisor, should recuse herself from discussing this report because of that conflict. I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, he said that she would need to disclose the money the town spent on this report as a campaign donation.
Oh.
Which, again, I don't think he was being literal there. I think that was him
more sarcasm.
suggesting that a challenger town clerk would benefit from the things made in this report.
That's Liam May, the news editor from The River Reporter, talking to us about the Highland Town Board's finalized audit of the town clerk's office. You can read about that report and follow the developments in this developing story at riverreporter.com. Thank you so much, Liam.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Tim Bruno. Remember, you can hear Tim with an hour of local news and conversations on Radio Catskill every weekday morning at 10, only here on Radio Catskill. We've got a lot more news coming up, including fresh warnings from health officials that e-cigarettes are targeting children. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Local Edition, winner of Excellence in Broadcasting Awards from the New York State Broadcasters Association. Radio Catskill. Listen local.
Things are changing in Europe. Trump has spooked the Europeans into thinking more seriously about their defense. And the idea of a threat from Russia that goes beyond Ukraine is starting to seep into the European psyche.
I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on the Daily from the New York Times.
It's a local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Well, students are getting ready to head back to school this fall. Will they be bringing e-cigarettes with them? Health officials are warning that a new wave of e-cigarettes is targeting kids, with some even disguised as everyday objects or with built-in video games. Despite crackdowns, more than 1.6 million youth still use e-cigarettes. Most of them prefer flavored products, which are largely on the market illegally. Experts say nicotine use at young ages can have serious lasting effects. Radio Catskill's Annie Bennett spoke with Brian King, Executive Vice President for U.S. Programs at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids.
as kids are headed back to school, we want to make sure that parents as well as educators are mindful of an important public health risk, and that's tobacco product use, particularly e-cigarettes as well as other emerging products. And we've seen considerable declines in tobacco product use among kids nationally. We're actually at the lowest levels in the past 25 years, but there's still over 2 million kids that are using these products.
So it was my understanding that most of these new vape products, like Juuls and Elf Bars, are not made from tobacco, but are made from nicotine. Is that correct?
According to the U.S., the Tobacco Control Act that was enacted by Congress in 2009, products containing nicotine that are derived from the tobacco plant are regulated as such.
Got it. Okay. And why are these so bad?
For one, it's a highly addictive drug. It can also harm the developing adolescent brain, particularly the part that's responsible for learning and memory and attention. And it can also prime the brain for addiction to other drugs. And I'll add that the brain actually continues to develop till about age 25. Prohibiting people from using these products during youth and young adulthood could potentially protect them from a lifetime of addiction as adults.
And tell me about these new illegal vapes that I'm seeing in the news.
The vast majority of e-cigarettes on the marketplace are not authorized by FDA, and such are illegally on the market. At present, the only products that have been authorized e-cigarette-wise in the U.S. are tobacco-flavored and menthol-flavored. And so the variety of youth-appealing products out on the market, you know, everything ranging from fruit and candy to unicorn puke, whatever that tastes like, are indeed on the market illegally.
So you would say that they are being intentionally targeted towards youth?
The more recent varieties of these e-cigarettes come in a lot of youth-appealing ways, including resembling gaming devices, having Bluetooth, and some even resembling highlighters and other everyday objects. We know that the advertising is highly influential in getting them to start, as well as the flavors. And then, of course, the nicotine keeps them coming back for more. And so it's that trifecta of advertising, flavors, nicotine that influence youth, the use of these products.
So let's go back the last 10 or so years. Obviously, this is sort of a new thing. I'm 24, so I actually remember being in middle school when Juuls started getting really popular and were being marketed towards kids, and it completely changed the market from my memory. And my perception is that before that, cigarette use among teens was at an all-time low, and we sort of almost beat it. And then these products come in again, and they spike. Is that an accurate perception? How does that all play out over the last 15 years?
Yeah, so we started to see declines in cigarette smoking among kids in the United States in 1998. And the reason is because a master settlement agreement was implemented, and it basically prohibited a lot of the ways where these products were being advertised to kids. That said, with the introduction of e-cigarettes, which entered the U.S. around 2008, we subsequently started to see increases among kids. And that peaked in 2019, where we had over 5 million kids that were using e-cigarettes in this country. And so since 2019, we've seen a 70% decline in e-cigarette use among kids. It's now at the lowest levels that we've seen in a decade, but there's still more work to do. There's over 2 million kids using tobacco products. And we also want to be mindful that there's new products entering the marketplace. And so the only tobacco product where we've actually seen a slight uptick within the past couple of years is nicotine pouches.
What do parents need to know?
Yeah, so ultimately it comes down to regulation and education. You've got the U.S. Food and Drug Administration and other federal agencies that are working very diligently to remove illegal products from the shelves and to protect kids. But the education piece is also important as well, and that's where everyone serves a role in terms of parents and educators. And so what they can do is make sure they're looking for the signs and symptoms of nicotine addiction. And so headed back in the school year, looking for behavior changes, whether that's mood, changes in sleep pattern, changes in eating patterns. These can all be indicative of being exposed to nicotine. And if they're seeing those, it's important to have a conversation with kids. And we do know based on the evidence that shorter, more frequent touch points can be more effective than a longer sit down. And what you don't want to be is punitive either, because we know we're dealing with a highly addictive drug in nicotine. And so if you do have a youth who's using these products, it's important that you get them to help. And that is in the form of a healthcare provider and a pediatrician who can set up a best plan to make sure they quit and can get back to peak learning back at school.
And how do parents distinguish those symptoms versus normal teenager things like mood changes, appetite, sleep, etc. That could be vape use, but it also could be puberty.
Yeah, there's certainly other factors that could lead to some of these. And this is where I think a conversation is really important. And you also want to be mindful of looking for signs of these products themselves. Some of these products can be easily concealed. And so it's important to be aware of not only what they look like, but also those signs and symptoms, and then using all of that information to inform discussions with kids. And as I noted, it's really important that these not be, you know, punitive, because we are dealing with a highly addictive drug.
What are some of the specific issues that we're seeing rise in kids after long-term use?
We know that, of course, the lungs are designed to breathe clean air. And so when you're inhaling an aerosol that includes ultrafine particles, we have seen respiratory illness in kids. We also know that it impacts the prefrontal cortex.
What if I only vape every once in a while?
So we do know from the available science that even intermittent use of these products can lead to signs and symptoms of nicotine dependency. And so even if you're using it intermittently, that can still induce those intermediary pathways towards dependence and addiction. And so although most kids who are using these products aren't necessarily using it every day, that doesn't mean that it's not problematic. And all frequent users were at one time infrequent users. That's how dependency and addiction works. And it's particularly important to be mindful that the levels of nicotine in these products has increased over time.
What do you think the biggest takeaway for parents and for teens to know going into this new school year?
Biggest message is that tobacco product use, including e-cigarettes, continues to be a public health concern. And it's important that we're aware of those risks and also mindful of the evolving landscape of products. And if you do have a youth who is using these products, get them to a healthcare provider immediately. And if parents are interested in learning more, they can go to tobaccofreekids.org. And in the meantime, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Let's prevent them from starting to use these products in the first place.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate having you. From Liberty, I'm Annie Bennett for Radio Catskill.
And thank you, Annie, for that story, which was just the first of two stories that we have from Annie Bennett tonight. She now has news impacting folks with developmental disabilities and those that support them. And this looks to be a positive impact, as Hudson Valley nonprofit Abilities First has launched a new app called Abilibe. They were given a grant from New York to develop a statewide resource for the disabled community. As students go back to school and transition through different life phases, it can be hard to keep track of resources. Marcy Handler from Abilities First tells us more about the help the app will bring to New York families.
The purpose of the app was really to help families. The New York State system for transitioning through one system of service to another is very confusing and very difficult for folks to get information and figure out what they should be doing. So when parents go from one place to the next, they're often really confused about what they need to know, what they need to do. And the Council on Developmental Disabilities heard that this was a statewide issue.
Why is that? And how does this app bridge that gap?
Parents call the transition from school-based services to adult services the cliff. So that should give you an idea. It's a big change. They've been accustomed to working with the folks in the school districts. And when you transition to OPWDD, you have to do a lot of the work yourself. And it takes time. There are so many options and so many choices, it's hard to know what's the right thing for you. And everyone really would like to have planning that's just specific to them. So the guide is a step-by-step transition plan to get from one place to the next. For example, housing is its own huge category. We give you an overview of the things you might need to know, and then we link you to the New York Center Housing Resource Center. And we do the same thing for healthcare transition, which is going from a pediatrician to adult practitioner.
It seems like it's going to be a hugely revolutionary thing for New York. How is it different than what already exists for these families?
The app is divided into 10 different age groups, starting with early childhood and all the way up to mature adulthood. And each age group sort of has its own little focus, whether it's things you may encounter in the school districts or how to look for a job. And puberty is huge. So we're looking to bridge those gaps and provide some resources. We have a great curated library, and we take you step by step through each transition from each age group to the next.
Tell me about the process of starting this app.
We worked with the Council on Developmental Disabilities. We applied for funding through them, and our grant was for $400,000. And then we also contributed in our time and our own funding, 34% match. And we chose to do an app because it's on everybody's phone, it's accessible, easy to use, and it's been so far so good.
The disability rights tagline, "Nothing for us without us," is something that your organization holds very close to your mission. How you're honoring that with the creation of this app, what sort of collaboration has been going on with the disability community?
We didn't create this in a vacuum. We didn't just say, oh, let's just, you know, write, make an app. We had an advisory council. Folks all across the state who are also parents and advocates and self-advocates and work with the disability population every day. I mean, we all want to see our kids grow and flourish and, you know. And one of our parents that was so lovely, she said, you know, it should be like that sign at the zoo. You are here. And then you know where you came from. You know where you're going. And we kind of took that to heart.
Where do you see it growing from here?
Well, we add new content on a regular basis. We didn't really delve into how to get mental health resources for somebody. And that's a wonderful area that we should be talking about.
And I'm sure with Medicaid and the Department of Education cuts coming in, the resources are going to change. How did you personally get involved in this?
I have been writing grants for a lifetime. First, my husband was a early intervention provider for pediatrics. So I remember the stories from parents, the Christmas cards that would come. And she climbed the stairs to pet the cat. You know, this was something we never thought she could do. That kind of a sentiment that helping little tiny things that we take for granted every day.
Why is it called a Bilibi?
We have a nod to abilities first, you know, obviously. And a bee has been a historical symbol of the perfect community. And we thought that really kind of summed up what our goal is.
Talk to me about what you're feeling right now.
I am so proud of it all. You know, it's so exciting. I did a presentation and one woman wrote, when my husband and I just got our son's diagnosis and we're walking to the car, we said, now what? And she said, you must have been reading my mind when you made this app.
Obviously, this is for all of New York State, but is there anything that you've noticed from this region in particular that you think this app will support?
I think the Hudson Valley is very well resourced. I think we have some incredible work going on. But, you know, when we saw this opportunity to have a bigger impact and a wider reach across the state and be strong advocates for our folks, I mean, we couldn't pass the opportunity up.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate you being here and have a great day.
Thank you, Annie Bennett, for that story. That's going to do it for the Local Edition tonight. I'm Jason Dole. I'll be back here again with you tomorrow to bring you more local news and conversations at this time. 5 days a week at 6 o'clock in the evening here on the Local Edition. We've got local news and conversations 5 days a week every weekday morning with Radio Chatskill. And it's all thanks to listeners like you that support this public radio station. And you can do the same if you haven't done so ever or recently. Go to WJFFradio.org to make your donation. WJFFradio.org. For now, stay with us. We have more news on the way from The Daily. This is Radio Catskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Grizzly Bagels, small-batch handmade New York-style bagels in Roscoe, New York, grizzlybagels.com. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Seasonal folk songs, recent releases, traditional songs about country and city life, the finest songwriters. Rebecca Little Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, is bursting with folk music from Britain and Ireland. Sunday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.